The Guardian.
I'm John Dennis. Welcome to Guardian Weekly, international news and analysis from our team on June the 4th. This week calls for a green revolution as world leaders discuss rising food prices that have left 100 million hungry. The writer Naomi Klein on Police State 2.0, China's high-tech surveillance coming soon to a high street near you.
There are cameras everywhere, not just like one camera at the door, but directed at every screen.
Also this week, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is facing calls to step down as he fights allegations of corruption. And what some remarkable recordings made in London in the 1920s tell us about the lives of West Africans. A 100 million more people have gone hungry over the past year because they can't afford basic foodstuffs, including wheat, corn and soya. Climate change and the switch to biofuels have made food production more costly. And rising food prices have triggered riots in more than 30 countries worldwide. Earlier this week, world leaders gathered in Rome to discuss the problem. Well, before we hear from the summit, let's hear Tim Lang from London's City University. Professor Lang coined the phrase food miles, and he's pioneered research into food additives, obesity, diet and poverty.
Well, the optimists think that it'll all go away, food prices will come down and the problems will ease. The problem is more fundamental than that. There are some fundamental problems about oil dependency, water shortages looming, growth of population, changes of diet, all the things that are beginning to emerge on the international scene. The OECD is coming out with a report where they're saying food prices are going to come down, but they will remain at a much higher level than they were 2 years ago. Governments on their own can't do very much unless the supply chains change, unless consumers change. But I do think governments have underplayed their hand. They have retreated to saying, let markets decide. The reality is governments have a huge amount of involvement in the food system. Agriculture is not the only factor in food. Agriculture, in fact, is a small factor in food. What happens to food after the farm gate, when it's processed, whether it's processed, how it's processed, how much energy is used, how it's retailed, how it's trucked up and down Europe, whether it's flown, whether it's shipped, how far we have to go in a car to get to the shop. All of those factors are about sustainability. I think now we're beginning to know what a sustainable food system must address. It must be low energy, low carbon. It must be water conscious. It must reduce the embedded water that we have in food. It's going to have to address issues of climate change. It's got to address nutrition, which it's not doing at the moment. We've got a major problem of obesity. So I think we've got the beginnings of understanding the criteria by which a food system could be judged as sustainable. The big problem is that is going to be difficult to achieve.
Tim Lang. Well, Julian Borges, our diplomatic editor, he spoke to me from Rome, where the UN summit on food is taking place. He said there have been calls for a green revolution in food production.
That's one of the long-term ways of dealing with the summit. It doesn't obviously deal with the immediate needs of the hungry now, but in terms of the long term, the food experts are pointing out that they've been warning for years, if not decades, that the world is under-investing in agriculture. Agriculture has been the poor relation when it comes to handing out international aid money and budget money by national governments. And this is the result. We had this sudden crisis caused by long-term decline in supply and a sudden jump in demand.
What are the options for the world's wealthiest countries?
Oh, for the wealthy countries, what they're being asked to do is start investing in agriculture, particularly in Africa. But they're also being asked to look at their own consumption priorities. They're being asked in particular to look at the use of corn, mostly in the US, for biofuel, for corn ethanol, and whether that makes sense from the environmental point of view, but also from the point of view of food, because 40% of American corn is now being used to create ethanol rather than food. So there's an element there. They're also being asked to look again at their lifestyles, whether Western consumption patterns, which are now being copied in India and China, are sustainable from the point of view of the world's ability to cater to them.
The World Bank announced a rapid response fund last week to help the world's poorest countries. What other short-term measures are there that will help people immediately in need of food?
Well, food aid is number one. Also giving out inputs like fertilizer, like seeds for the next harvest in places like Africa, where people have gone hungry and have eaten the seeds and not been able to afford the fertilizer for their next harvest. So you're storing up problems for later in the year. So at the same time as giving out food, there's a call to give out those kind of inputs. Also to stop export bans, because the instant response of some governments has been to stop exporting rice and other staple foods, and that's contributed to the volatility in the market and fed into speculation on world food markets. So those are some of the instant responses they're looking at this week in Rome.
Is there anything approaching agreement on what to do in Rome?
Well, on the easy things, yes, that it's a good idea to bump up food aid and aid to farmers. On the longer term issues, no, there isn't really. US Secretary of Agriculture, Schaefer, has just been here defending the US emphasis on corn ethanol, claiming that it's responsible only for 3% in the rise of global food prices. Now, that's a figure that many here will take issue with, and it's going to be one that's going to be argued over the course of this week. And perhaps that's the biofuel issue is the most contentious. But there's also the issue of trade, whether free trade is the answer to this crisis, or one of the answers to the crisis, or whether it will worsen it, as some activists say. US and Britain, particularly Gordon Brown, has set a lot of store by a new round of trade liberalisation called the Doha Round as being one of the ways out of the crisis. But critics have said that may just, in the short term and medium term, actually lead to a rise in the price of food staples, because when poor countries in Africa are able to export money and make money from exporting food to the EU, that will raise the price in domestic markets in Africa and in the developing world. So it may not help, activists say. So there's a division over the impact of free trade and over biofuels. So those are probably the two hottest issues at the Rome summit.
Julian, among the delegates at this summit, we've got President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran and also President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe. What's been the reaction to his presence at the summit?
Well, Mugabe's presence has been particularly controversial because his economic mismanagement has been widely blamed for the food issues in Zimbabwe. And Zimbabwe should not only be able to feed itself, but be a big food exporter. And because of the collapse of Zimbabwean agriculture over recent years, and the overwhelming analysis is that it's just simple government mismanagement, Zimbabwe has been a country on the brink of hunger and malnutrition. So his presence here has been criticised, particularly by the British government, as one of grandstanding and an absurdity. One British minister said it was like Pol Pot going to a human rights convention.
Julian Borgia. China is using new technologies with help from Western multinational companies to develop an ultra-modern system of surveillance. The UK government will be watching the Beijing Olympics with interest to see the high-tech security system in action. The anti-globalisation writer Naomi Klein says China's so-called Golden Shield, its people-watching machine, is already in evidence in the new city of Shenzhen.
What's important to understand about Shenzhen is that it's always been a laboratory. Shenzhen as a city didn't exist in 1980. It was chosen as one of China's first special economic zones. So it was a small fishing village. And now is a city of 12.4 million people. And it began as this experiment in capitalism. And the theory was, when it was turned into a special economic zone, is that China would hold on to its socialist soul, but in this special area, the rules of free market would be allowed to apply. And then the idea was to get the benefits of capitalism, but contain its negative side effects, like some sort of toxic waste inside the zone. Now, as we know, this experiment in capitalism was so successful that it spread to the broader Pearl River Delta. This is right across from Hong Kong. There are 100,000 factories in the Pearl River Delta, roughly. And basically, chances are that almost everything that you own, or maybe three quarters of everything you own, was made in one of those factories, your computer, your iPhone, your iPod, your jeans, just everything is made there. And what I'm showing in this piece is that Shenzhen is once again a laboratory. It's a new kind of laboratory. It's a laboratory for the surveillance state or a kind of police state 2.0. The Chinese government has decided to road test a series of technologies like biometric IDs, network CCTV cameras. There are going to be 2 million CCTV cameras, and the idea is to network them all. The cameras are both in public spaces and also in privately owned spaces, but all of them networked. And this is what's different between London and China. In London, you do, as you know, have a lot of CCTV cameras, 500,000, and more than anywhere else in the world. But you can't have this level of integration between public and private cameras, which is what they're doing in China. And there hasn't been the integration of facial recognition software and biometric IDs that they're trying in China. So Shenzhen was born as a laboratory, and it is a laboratory still.
What kind of private spaces will host these CCTVs?
They already do. Internet cafes, what they call entertainment venues, which is everything from karaoke bars to restaurants, religious sites as well, are required by law to have CCTV cameras. There are cameras everywhere in the cafes, not just like one camera at the door, but directed at every screen and feeding directly into the local police station. And the other way in which the internet cafes are under surveillance is that now in Guangzhou and Shenzhen, you can't get online without, first of all, showing your national ID. And then with that ID, you get a new special pass card, which you use to get on the internet. And what that means is that your surfing can be under surveillance. And if you are somebody who's been tagged or flagged by local authorities, if you're on a blacklist, then as soon as you log into the computer, theoretically an alarm goes off and your activities are monitored.
Can you tell us about Golden Shield? Because this is the sort of Chinese state system that brings together these different kinds of technologies to create this kind of 21st century Big Brother.
Exactly. Golden Shield is the name given to what we're describing. It's the networking of all of these surveillance technologies. And this is the big difference. It's not the tools themselves, because there are places in Europe that are using biometric ID cards. As we know, there's an incredible proliferation of CCTV cameras. We know in the United States that there's been a great deal of cooperation between the big telephone companies to hand over email correspondence, to do warrantless wiretapping of phones. And there are several lawsuits going on about that now. What Golden Shield does is it integrates it all together to create this shield. And this is an attempt by the Chinese government to have the benefits of the information age without the risks. And of course, there are great risks to an authoritarian regime if their people are able to get access to any kind of information they want, but also use these tools of the information age to build movements. In recent years, there's been a major spike in protests in China.
Naomi Klein. Ehud Olmert, the Israeli Prime Minister, is under increasing pressure to resign over corruption allegations. The Labour Party, Olmert's main coalition partner and led by his Defence Minister Ehud Barak, has threatened to force an early general election. Olmert denies any wrongdoing and says he won't resign. Rory McCarthy is in Jerusalem for The Guardian.
This investigation is about payments that he has received over the last 15 years or so from, in particular, an American businessman and fundraiser. This businessman, whose name is Morris Talansky, testified in a court in Jerusalem that over the last 15 years, this is when Olmert was the mayor of Jerusalem and also when he was a minister in the government and when he was campaigning for these positions, that Olmert received about $150,000, most of it given in cash stuffed into envelopes. Now, investigators are looking at this to see if there was any bribery involved, to see if there was any breach of campaign finance laws, and to see if there was any question of money laundering. Olmert himself has been very clear in denying any allegations of wrongdoing. He's not been charged with a crime, and he says that he will not resign unless he is charged with any crime.
And at least part of this cash from Morris Talansky is alleged to have been spent on luxury goods and five-star hotels. What's all this done to Olmert's popularity with the voters in Israel?
Well, as you can imagine, it's not done him a tremendous amount of good. I mean, his popularity, even before all of this came out, was pretty poor. This is the fifth investigation that he's faced since he became prime minister just over 2 years ago. Some of the other corruption investigations have ended without any charge. Others are still being pursued right now. He's also courted a lot of unpopularity because of his handling of the war in Lebanon in the summer of 2006. There was an official government inquiry about the way that the Israeli government conducted that war, and that was extremely critical of the political and military leadership and of Ehud Olmert as well. So for several months now, his popularity has been really poor, and it's fair to say this has damaged it even more.
And he's under mounting pressure from his coalition partners and from within his own Kadima party to resign now. I mean, how long can he survive?
Well, I mean, Olmert is a very efficient political operator. Probably his greatest strength is the stuff that we don't see, the behind-the-scenes work that he does to keep his coalition together. He's a very astute political operator. I suspect that he will be able to hang on for a fair bit longer, although, as you rightly say, the pressure really is mounting against him. It's quite a complex situation because he leads the Kadima Party, which is the largest party in a coalition government. Now, some of his rivals come from within that party or from other parties within that coalition, and they are quite clearly eager to take over as prime minister themselves. But they have to play it very carefully, because if they push too hard and if they force a collapse in the government and a resort to early elections, then they're going to be in big trouble, because the opinion polls quite clearly show, and have done for several months, that if there were to be an election in Israel tomorrow, the party that would win would be the Likud, the right-wing party led by Benjamin Netanyahu, a former prime minister. So those within Olmert's party who are eager to try and make capital out of this, to try and win that prime ministership for themselves, have to play this very carefully.
Olmert met the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas on Monday before heading off for Washington to meet George Bush. I mean, how have doubts over Olmert's political future affected the ongoing peace talks with the Palestinians?
Well, as the corruption investigation has appeared and then all these revelations have come out, the peace process has sort of somehow continued. Talks are being held fairly regularly now between the Israeli and Palestinian leadership, and have been so since November last year, when this whole process was launched with a great deal of fanfare at the time, I should say. But I think it's become pretty obvious to most people on the ground and to those Israelis and Palestinians who were involved in the negotiations that not an awful lot has been achieved, and that there's not a great sign that anything significant will be achieved. So even if you subtract the corruption investigation from this equation, the peace process was not looking good. But there's no doubt that Olmert's sort of political fragility at the moment is not going to help things at all.
Rory McCarthy. Now, with me in the studio, Natalie Bennett, editor of the print edition of Guardian Weekly. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, John.
You're going to tell us some of the highlights in this week's newspaper, including Simon Jenkins on reform of an esteemed international institution.
He's looking at the whole issue of accountability in the UN. And I think this is something that's going to get quite a good debate going on our letters pages, because he compares the UN to the Eurovision Song Contest and says the results that are coming out are rather curious and not quite what we might have expected, and a serious concern. He looks at how NGOs are trying to introduce that accountability, but unfortunately nothing seems to be working.
Oh dear, null point. The happiest people on earth, where are they?
Oddly enough, in Iceland. The weather might be very cold, very wet and very dark, but they're having a lovely time up there. And the interesting question, we've got a great piece, the front of our weekly review section, looks at how this very poor fishing nation 100 years ago at the bottom of European development leagues has now got top marks for wealth, health and education. And the answer seems to be a high literacy rate and some very strong women in there. That's what's made the difference.
And a piece that we've taken from Le Monde about international peacekeepers in Chad.
We've been covering for some time the arrival of these and the difficulty they've had in putting the force together. But now they're there, there's a bit of a question. What are they actually supposed to be doing? The idea is that they're addressing the problems in the neighbouring Darfur region of Sudan. But that problem isn't what they're seeing in Chad. What they're seeing in Chad is a sort of great deal of brigandism, of highwaymen, in an old English term, and soldiers aren't necessarily the best people to deal with that situation.
Well, thanks very much for that, Natalie. And don't forget, you can sign up to Guardian Weekly if you want to read those aforementioned articles, plus much, much more, guardianweekly.co.uk. And if you do that now, you can get 4 free editions. I'm John Dennis, and you're listening to Guardian Weekly. Still to come, a letter from one of our listeners, this week in Niger. The lives of West Africans in the 1920s are captured in a remarkable archive of recordings. But first, about 2 million people live in Tijuana, a city just over the border from San Diego in California. But it's also been the scene of an escalating war between Mexico's drug traffickers, as Joe Tuckman reports.
Just over the border from California, Tijuana has never enjoyed an exactly squeaky reputation, not least for being the base for one of Mexico's oldest drug trafficking organizations, the Arellano Felix cartel. But over the last couple of years, the underworld has come to the surface like never before, and the city is now one of the worst hotspots in a brutal countrywide turf war to control trafficking routes and local markets. And the situation is getting worse, despite, or perhaps because of, a massive government-led offensive against the cartels involving tens of thousands of soldiers and military police that was launched 18 months ago. Nearly 1,400 people have died in drug-related violence so far this year. That's almost 50% up on the already record figure for the same period last year. Rampant corruption is blamed by many for the failure of the crackdown so far, and no institution is considered dirtier than the local police forces. But what does the war look like through the eyes of Tijuana's 2,400 municipal policemen as they patrol the city?
It's frightening, really frightening. People might think the police are prepared, but it isn't true. You get goosebumps and all nervous. It is really frightening.
Officer Roberto Silva was in the first patrol car called to sort out what he was told was a street fight in a middle-class barrio. Instead of a fight, he found a safe house where six hitmen were hauled up with huge quantities of ammunition. It took the authorities 3 hours to take the house.
I reckon there were about 300 municipal officers. Then the army came and the federal police, and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of bullets fired.
While his partner strokes his R-15 semi-automatic rifle and nods in agreement, Silver insists that the police are largely powerless to combat the narco bosses, who move about town accompanied by carloads of bodyguards.
The drug traffickers have lots of power and lots of very powerful weapons, much better than the ones we have. So if we bump into a caravan of 4 or 5 vehicles filled with 20 heavily armed criminals with automatic rifles, what on earth are we to do?
Most of the victims of Mexico's drug wars are traffickers themselves, but as the offensive has grown, so too is the number of soldiers and police included in the death toll. Some of Tijuana's cops are terrified that they could be next.
If I see somebody try to kill somebody, I scare.
There are, of course, those who admit that they like the danger. Alejandro Legaña says that he has been in 3 shootouts and lost 10 colleagues to the violence, but that he still gets a bit of a buzz when he takes his 9mm pistol out of his holster.
There's an adrenaline rush. It's exciting. Something happens in your body, and anybody who becomes a policeman likes this at least a bit.
As Legaña waits at the traffic light, a large SUV draws up beside his patrol car, and the driver pointedly turns up the stereo. Inevitably, it's Narco Corridas, a kind of ballad that glorifies traffickers' exploits and has many fans in this part of the world. A few minutes later, the police radio frequency is interrupted by similar music, with an obscene taunt thrown in for good measure. You fucking idiot, the voice says. You're going to be fired. The taunt hits a very sore point among officers frightened that they will lose their jobs in a clean-up vowed by a new crusading police chief called Alberto Capella. The officers say he's sacking good cops on rumours alone. Capella says the situation is too serious to wait to build up a watertight legal case.
This is like a cesspit, but it's completely full, and the work to empty it's going to be huge. And as soon as you start it, it starts smelling worse than it did when you started, because the amount of waste that's been deposited there over time is absolutely huge.
Joe Tuckman reporting. 80 years ago, a series of recordings were made of West African musicians. The Zonophone Record Company, a forerunner of EMI, released them as gramophone discs between 1927 and 1930. It was a commercial decision by the company to dominate the West African market. But the musicians themselves were recorded in London, and now they're being released on CD, allowing us to hear them for the first time. Mark Ainley from Honest John's Records is the man who put the CD together.
Hey, baby, now, when I'm in the shower, we We're in the basement of Honest John's Records in West London, which is, to anybody who's interested in music, it's an Aladdin's cave, to coin a journalistic cliche, of music, and sort of surrounded by vinyl and CDs and so on. And with me is Mark Ainley from Honest John's, and he's the man who put together Living is Hard, West African Music in Britain, 1927 to 29. Now, Mark, these were recordings made by Zonophone. They were recorded for a West African audience. They weren't recorded for sort of Western people who are, you know, the sort of Guardian readers, if you like, of the time, who may have been interested in African music. They were actually West African musicians recorded for West African audience.
Yeah, like a lot of the international recordings, there was huge output that EMI and the forerunners of EMI orchestrated in those three decades. They were intended to be all sent back to those countries where the music originated from.
They were also not only trying to sell gramophone records, but they were trying to sell gramophone equipment as well. I mean, was there much of a market there for gramophone equipment and records?
I think in the first few years of the 1930s, they sold something like 30,000 records to West Africa. You can find photographs of gramophone company record shops, you know, in Asia Minor, somewhere in Asia Minor, where the windows are full of horns and players, and obviously if you go in the 78s.
One thing that struck me listening to Living is Hard is the quality of the sound recordings, because I think a lot of people, when they imagine sort of gramophone records, they imagine something very crackly, and that gives it a kind of patina of age to them, but these are incredibly clear.
The music on Living is Hard was recorded by the Gramophone Company a few years before it merged with other companies and became EMI at the beginning of the 1930s, in Hayes, in West London, at the same time that Robeson is recording and Elgar is recording, and their electrical recordings, it's in the new manner, and so they really belong to the modern recording period, unlike, say, recording of, say, 3 or 4 years previously.
And to put this CD together, you've spent 18 months going through this enormous archive at Hayes of EMI's recordings. Can you tell us a bit about the Hayes archive?
Well, it's housed in the same premises as the factory and offices that by the end of the 1920s were employing 7,500 people. At that time, they had their own timber yard. You know, they were building record players and things. They had their own fire service. They had their own railway inside the complex. It was an amazing, huge facility. I love this one called Obu Kofi because there's a real lovely tension between singing a song, which is arranged with his collaborators, and him just erupting into his sort of demotic tongues. When we had it translated, I found out that it's actually a beautiful lyric about settling over nations, which one presumes are warring, like a bird. And you settle over it with your wings and your feathers, and you calm the whole thing down, and the divisions disappear, which I thought was very nice.
Mark, thanks very much for talking to us. And Living is Hard, West African Music in Britain, 1927 to 1929, is out now on Honest John's Records. Staying in Africa now, every week one of our listeners or readers of the Guardian weekly newspaper tell us something of life in their part of the world. This week, a letter from Niger from Maggie Fick.
Thick white smoke from pungent homemade incense floods out of the salon and mixes with women's voices. The sounds of a traditional mandolin and a violin compete with the dull roar of the ladies' gossip. Men in long flowing robes and white turbans sit around drinking tea outdoors under an open tent. It is 9 a.m. on Saturday morning, and this wedding has been underway for 2 hours. The Fatiha, the religious prayer which consecrates the marriage, took place just after 7 a.m., as is custom in Niger. Ramatu, the bride, is in her bedroom. She is lying under a blanket in anticipation of tonight, when her groom and his family will come and take her to her new home. She does not look nervous. Instead, she seems to be trying to contain her excitement and her shy smile, because all young brides in Niger should be modest and demure on their wedding day. After the Fatiha, the first meal of the day is served. Hot millet porridge is passed around, along with plenty of cups of sweet green tea. Afterwards, everyone relaxes, women feed their babies, and the young Tuareg guitar players arrive to set up for the afternoon concert. Soon the women brought in from the village to cook for the wedding are back to work, stirring huge steaming pots of meat, an entire cow was sacrificed for the wedding, and frying potatoes in vats of oil over an open fire. Petite elderly women with wrinkly skin and cracked feet jump up and down as they pound a wooden stick into a metal pot that is almost taller than they are, throwing their weight into turning the starchy millet paste around in the pot. Around 3 p.m., one of the amps set up for the concert issues some serious feedback, and the sensual electric guitar music begins. Children and toddlers run outside of the compound to join the crowd gathering on the street, while women elbow each other to get in good position for observing the show. The men have retired to the groom's family's house, so this concert is mostly for the women and children. One of the guitarists pulls down his turban to expose his mouth and begins to sing in Tamashek, the Tuareg language. Women ululate and clap, and before long, the dance floor is packed, and adolescent boys look on in awe as their mothers go crazy on the dance floor. A wedding is the best excuse women have here to buy nice clothes, dress up, and have fun with their friends. Most of the women are beaming and looking radiant in elaborate sequin dresses and deep indigo headdresses. Everyone seemed to be enjoying themselves, which Ramatu was happy to hear when I went back to her bedroom and found her straining to listen through the door while her grandma dozed beside her.
Maggie Fick, a letter from Niger. Guardian Weekly this week was produced by Ian Chambers. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.